Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Emmett Till is one of the most famous names in the history of modern race relations in this country. A little later, we'll talk with the murdered Till's cousin who was with him when the 14-year-old was abducted in 1955. But first, we turn to the history now being written by the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Thousands are signing up daily following the disastrous rollout in October. We're spending time today on an update on where we are in the process of navigating the system. Joining me in studio are Professor Sidney Watson with the Health Law Policy Center at St. Louis University, and Jen Bursdale is Executive Director of Missouri Healthcare for All, a statewide grassroots organization that works to ensure that all Missourians have access to affordable, quality health care choices. Thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you both.
Good to be here.
I'd like to ask the same question to both of you. I'll start with you, Sidney Watson. What headline would you give the rollout so far?
As of today, I think the headline would be 2.2 million Americans have new private insurance coverage through the marketplace.
And Jen?
What headline would I give? I think, you know, new insurance options make it affordable and possible for people to have access to health care.
How is it going here in our area? Jen, I'll put this question to you first, online and offline.
Really, right now, we think it's going very well. We've been working to talk to people all over the state and are hearing a lot of people who are signing up, finding plans that are better than what they had available to them before, more affordable than they ever had available, both those who get discounts and those who don't. And really, people grateful to be able to take advantage of both the website and also the services available through helper organizations.
We were talking before you went on the air about the early publicity. I referred to it as a disastrous rollout, and I could see each of you look at each other saying, I wish he hadn't used that word. But Sidney, it was a disaster to start with.
It absolutely was a disaster. It was rocky. It was frustrating for people. But I think we've moved forward from that. Healthcare.gov, the website, is working well. It's working smoothly now. And just as importantly, we have a lot of trained helpers in this area who know how to help people navigate and choose plans. Those services are free and available daytime, nighttime, weekends, and on the phone.
The numbers that we can cite, there's some new numbers came out nationally this week, but I understand you have some locally indicating how well it's going.
Yes. As of December 28th here in Missouri, we had a little over 33,000 Missourians who had signed up for plans through the marketplace, and another almost 26,000 Missourians who have newly enrolled in Medicaid. So that's almost 60,000 newly insured Missourians, or mostly newly insured. Some of those may have signed up for new plans, changing their plans and getting better plans.
What is the optimum number for Missouri, potentially? Do you have any figure like that?
Well, we know we went into this with 800,000 uninsured Missourians, about 500,000 of those eligible to buy plans on the marketplace. So we have a ways to go, but we've got a little time to get there. People have until March 31st to sign up for plans on the marketplace.
That's an important date.
Huge date.
Obviously. You know, you mentioned the number of people signing up for Medicaid. That may confuse a lot of folks because the Medicaid situation here and the fact that the legislature has not chosen to expand Medicaid here leaves about 300 people in the dark, out in the cold, if you will.
About 300,000 people without any options. But these 26,000 Missourians we see signing up, we think most of them are children who have been eligible for Medicaid and our children's health insurance program, but who didn't realize it. And we think what's happening is their parents are going to the marketplace looking for options and realizing that there is this very good option for their children and they're getting signed up.
Right. Jen, the numbers are out nationally this week, too. What do the demographics of those numbers tell us? There are a lot more older people than there are younger people.
That is what those initial statistics show. And, of course, people are very interested in what the sign-up rates were for the first few months. And there were more older people than younger people. But actually, there's a significant percentage of those younger people signing up. And it's important to remember that that's only halfway through this first open enrollment period. So we expect to continue to see people of all ages enrolling through March 31st, certainly encourage people to do so. And I think to withhold final judgment until we really have the numbers for the full period.
You're expecting, everyone is expecting the younger folks to come in at the end because that's kind of the way younger folks operate. Is that correct?
I think we know that the people who have been most anxious about not having health insurance will sign up first. And that's some of who signed up right away, folks that knew they had doctor's appointments they needed to make as soon as they could, and they wanted that insurance coverage January 1st. The folks that are less concerned, they might sign up closer to that March 31st deadline.
You've got some very positive stories to tell about specific individual cases.
We do. We've been talking to people throughout the state and really are hearing wonderful stories about people signing up. A lot of people who were uninsured before. So a woman who is retired, living in Southeast Missouri, not yet Medicare age. She's been uninsured while she takes care of her husband who is on disability. She signed up for a plan for just over $100 a month for a really good plan. We know a student in Springfield who's in school full-time, working two part-time jobs, has been uninsured since she left home at 18. She signed up for a plan that's going to cost her $7 a month.
Sydney, you need more stories like this to make their way to the front pages of the newspapers.
Well, it certainly lets people know what's available. We know when we began the marketplace back in October that 80% of people who are eligible for new options through the marketplace did not know about it. The latest surveys tell us that about 50% of people who are eligible for reduced price premiums through the marketplace still don't know about it. So it's helpful to have shows like this to get the word out.
Some of the figures that I've seen would indicate that I think the number was 80% of those who are signed up so far are women. Does that tell us anything?
Maybe that women take care of families and tend to worry more about people's health. The other important statistic we've seen is 80% of the people who've signed up for marketplace plans are getting financial help with their premiums and cost sharing.
I wonder, Jen, how well understood that is, this whole business of subsidies.
I think it's confusing for a lot of people. It's a new system. It's a new type of help available. But certainly as people find out that they qualify for help, they're very excited. You can get that information through the website healthcare.gov, also websites such as KFF, KaiserFamilyFoundation.org, and through any of those organizations in the community that can help you navigate that information.
Well, we'll put those websites and that information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Sydney, I'm going to turn back to you because you are also an attorney, and there's a lot, there are a lot of legal issues that are trailing along this whole operation. Let me see if I have this right. A couple of weeks ago, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor put a hold on the contraception clause, if you will, in the Affordable Care Act. The Justice Department responded to that, and now it's back in Justice Sotomayor's court. She has to determine what to do next. What are her options here?
Well, part of what's going on is there have been cases filed in at least four courts of appeals across the country challenging the contraceptive coverage. As you'll remember, the Affordable Care Act for most health plans provides that we can get preventive care without having to pay part of that cost. And an expert panel decided that some of that preventive care includes contraceptive coverage for women of childbearing age because it helps women's protect their health to plan their children. As those cases have been working their way through the court, one of the issues is whether the contraceptive mandate should be stayed as those cases work through the court. And Justice Sotomayor on New Year's Eve issued a stay on a case coming out of Denver, out of Colorado. And it's now being briefed whether that stay will be in place while those cases work through the court. The court is also deciding whether to take one of those cases. And I expect they probably will. We need a decision on that issue.
Does this particular case involving a group of nuns, as I recall, Would this tend to accelerate that process in terms of footing it before the full court?
Well, we actually have 4 Court of Appeals decisions now, yeah. So we're likely to see it go up. The issue in that case is that the Little Sisters of the Poor and Christian Brothers are religious organizations. They hire a number of employees. They are not eligible for the narrow religious exemption from the contraceptive coverage mandate. So the compromise that had been worked out, the accommodation, was if they self-certify that they are religious not-for-profit and that providing contraceptive coverage violates their religious beliefs, that they will not themselves have to provide the contraceptive coverage, but that their insurance companies or their third-party administrators will pay for the contraceptive coverage for their employers, allowing the religious orders to kind of step out of it. The religious orders have said that signing that statement also burdens their religious beliefs. They do not want to have to fill out the statement. And ultimately, that's going to be the issue that the Supreme Court will be addressing when they get to the merits. And I'm pretty sure that will happen. We just don't know when. And what will be required in the interim.
Jen, from your perspective, how is this playing out? I mean, how is this disrupting anything?
I think it depends on what part of the news people choose to follow. Missouri Healthcare for All actually has not been involved in that issue at all because it is such a small part of what's going on. It'll go through the court system. We'll have an answer. It really, you know, we don't want it to distract us from the fact that there are these new exciting insurance options available to people that really are going to make a difference in their lives. And Missouri has its own important decision to make about whether to expand Medicaid. We think that's really critical.
Yeah. That seems to be a non-starter if we believe what we read in the papers about the legislature's approach to this.
We don't believe it's a non-starter. We don't believe it can be a non-starter. We have somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 Missourians that would qualify for it and that don't qualify for those discounts. So they really have no options right now. And to put it bluntly, people's lives are on the line. You know, we know people who don't have insurance live sicker, they die younger. And I can't think of anything more important for our legislators to do this spring than figure out a way to pass Medicaid expansion.
And it's free money up to a point.
It really is. Up until through 2016, the federal government pays 100% of the costs. After that, Missouri never pays more than 10%. So it's a phenomenal deal for the state. It's going to save and create jobs, protect our hospitals, but most importantly, save the lives of the people in the state.
And Cindy, you've been singing this song for a long time, ever since we started talking about the Affordable Care Act, about the Missouri Medicaid situation.
Absolutely. It's good for people's health. It's good for the state economy. As the Missouri Hospital Association's report written by the University of Missouri economist shows, it'll bring 24,000 jobs into the state. It's economic stimulus, too.
I have to take a break. We'll do that now, and then we'll continue our conversation about the Affordable Care Act, where it stands right now, and some of the deadlines that lie ahead, and how the whole process has been going. A lot of negative publicity early on. That seems to be changing, and at least that's what we're hearing today, and hope that's the case, because it did get off to a very poor start. My guests in studio, Professor Sidney Watson with the Health Law Policy Center at St. Louis University, and Jen Bursdale, Executive Director of Missouri Healthcare for All. We'll come back and continue the conversation. If you'd like to get in on it, please feel free to do so by giving us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or we'll take a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on the Affordable Care Act, an update from us today as we take a look at where it is and where it's going. But before we continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom are following today. A Missouri Senate committee is taking its first look at the latest round of Republican proposals to cut the state's income tax rates. Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones was joined by doctors today at a news conference. They highlighted the Republicans' push to reinstate state limits on the amount of money that patients can win in medical malpractice suits. And earlier today, the four Republican candidates for Illinois governor appeared together for the first time this year. Raising the state's minimum wage and pension reform were among the top topics at a Republican gubernatorial candidate forum in suburban Chicago. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Professor Sidney Watson of St. Louis University and Jen Bursdale of the Missouri Healthcare for All organization. I want to get back to another thing that seems to have been proving problematical for people. And again, the publicity on this thing has been swirling and a lot of misstatements, if you will, and folks not fully understanding what's going on. Part of this has been that folks who are signing up are finding out that they are spending more than they thought they were going to have to spend. Jenny, you're running into that.
I actually haven't run into that. The folks that we know that have signed up, you know, there have been some technical difficulties. They're navigating a new system. We expected that it would take a while before the system worked flawlessly. But by and large, people are signing up. They're making the payment that they expected to make, and they're delighted to have coverage.
Sidney, thoughts on that part of it?
We're hearing people very happy with the premiums and with the choices. We've got about 24 plans, not counting the catastrophic plans. Mm. They range from $750 deductibles for an individual on up, $1,500 deductible for a family. It's really nice new options.
Mm. Well, folks were told that they would not have to pay more for these policies, but in some cases they have.
Really depends on the income. I think some of the confusion was some of the older policies being canceled. In many cases, those were policies that seemed to have low premiums because they also had low coverage. I think as many people were able to get into the marketplace and see their new plans, what they had not realized was that they're eligible for new premium support, which brings down some of the cost of coverage for most people, for a family of four earning up to about $94,000 a year.
There are four options, Jen, that people have for these plans, from platinum down to silver, bronze, whatever. What are folks going for here?
So in Missouri, we have three of the four options. We have bronze, silver, and gold.
Why do we only have three?
And it happened in a lot of states. They're just the plans that the insurance companies chose to offer here. They're all good plans. They differ in how the costs are split. So with your bronze plan, you're going to pay less up front just every month to have the insurance. You pay less in your monthly premium, but you'll pay a little bit more when you use it. If you go up to a gold plan, you'll pay more for your monthly premium, but less when you use it. So your deductible will be lower. Your coinsurance will be lower. But really important to understand, these are all good plans. I heard you asking about, you know, plans that people thought they had that were affordable. In all of our time talking to people, we talked to a woman who had a really affordable health insurance plan. And a couple of years ago, she had a heart attack and found out that her affordable insurance plan didn't cover her trip to the ambulance. It didn't cover, you know, the care they provided in the ambulance. And she was capped at $200 a day toward the cost of her hospital stay, which is about the cost of an aspirin at the end of the hospital these days.
It certainly doesn't go very far. Let's go to the phones. We have some calls, and we'll bring the audience into this discussion. We'll take on Godson, it looks like, calling from St. Louis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I found out that many people who have very low income in Missouri don't even qualify at Marketplace for the affordable care. The Marketplace will refer them to Medicaid, which Missouri don't have any expansion. Is that not a very big disadvantage for those people? They will not be able to get into this program.
Jen,
go ahead.
It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem for, you know, several hundred thousand people. And as I like to say, this is a self-inflicted wound in this state. We could be signing these folks up for Medicaid. They could have coverage for preventive care, early treatment when they get sick. And instead, we've left them uninsured and uncovered.
Sidney, under the Act, are there any people of such income categories that cannot be covered by the Affordable Care Act?
Well, we have the Medicaid gap for Missourians, adults earning up to 100% of federal poverty. That's about $11,500 for a single person. There are no new options through the marketplace. That's what our Our legislature has to decide in terms of the Medicaid
expansion. We talk about the 300,000 who are not covered right now, but is there another group, a non-Medicaid group, that is involved in this? I'm a little unclear on that.
I'm not sure what you're asking about. I would want to say, in terms of new options here in the St. Louis area, for people who fall in this Medicaid gap, we have a gateway program through our community health centers. It's not complete insurance, but it does provide primary care and some prescription drugs coverage. And I would encourage people, if they're like Gus and have not been able to sign up because their income is too low, to contact your community health center and see if you can get some help through the Gateway program.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Mark calling from Kirkwood. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to point out that it's the Republican legislators that are blocking the Medicaid expansion, and I just hope people remember this when they go to the polls. That's all.
All right. Mark, thanks for the call. Jen, this is pretty much the same song that you're singing.
It's actually a little different from our song. We're a nonpartisan organization, and we really don't see this as a partisan issue. We've talked to legislators in both parties who know that expanding Medicaid is the right thing to do. We think this is a moral issue. We've got people whose lives are on the line who are suffering, and we think it's time to put those politics aside, and we think it's possible.
We have an email here from Joyce who writes, on December 3rd, I tried to enroll my daughter but was stalled by the state of Missouri. I've been waiting since early December for state Medicaid to officially tell me my daughter is not eligible before we can actually enroll in health care for her. Thanks to them, I'll have to pay the penalty. It's frustrating.
No one is going to have to pay the penalty as of today. You've got more time to sign up, more time to get that paperwork. So do not worry if you didn't get signed up by December 31st. You have until March 31st to get through the marketplace.
Let's talk a bit about that penalty that folks, so that folks understand exactly what that is. Jen, can you describe what we're talking about here?
Sure. So under the new law, most Americans are expected to have some kind of health insurance or be charged a penalty when you file your taxes. So people who do have to pay that penalty, they'll pay it next April 2015 when they file this year's taxes. There are exemptions if you can't get affordable health insurance, if you can't get it because we have an expanded Medicaid, if you have a religious objection. There's a lot of exceptions to that penalty. And if you sign up by March 31st for a plan this year, you won't have to worry about that penalty.
What, Sydney, is most misunderstood, do you think, about this whole process?
Well, I think most misunderstood is people not realizing that we have these new premium tax credits that bring down the cost of premiums for most people. We know that 80% of the people who have gotten new plans have gotten financial help. So it's really important to go to the website. You can window shop now, click in your zip code, click in your income, and you can see what it's likely to cost you for different plans and do some window shopping.
Mm-hmm. Jen, I think there are probably some folks out there who are maybe holding back because they think they have to do something online. But online is not the only option available to people.
That's true. It's not the only option. You can really, I think the best thing to do for a lot of people is to go to one of the many organizations locally that are helping people. They'll help you walk through the system, answer any questions. You can find the list online at healthcare.gov or covermissouri.org. There's an 800 number you can use to find someone. Some of the folks locally that are providing help are the community action agencies, community health centers, Planned Parenthood, St. Louis Effort for AIDS, lots of organizations where people can go get free in-person help.
We talked about the navigators a little while ago. Are the navigators only available through the online process, or are we saying that these organizations you're talking about are in effect navigators also?
Some of them are navigators, some are certified application counselors. To a consumer, there's not much of a difference. It's an organization where you can go. We suggest calling and making an appointment. You'll sit one-on-one with someone in privacy and, you know, get the help that you need to figure out what's best for you.
Is there any go ahead, Sydney.
And these are face-to-face help. This is your question about what's the alternative for people who don't want to go online. And that is these face-to-face helpers.
In terms of the process, is it faster to deal with someone face-to-face than to do it online?
I think it depends on who you are. Some people love to shop in the middle of the night from their home computer. Others think, you know, especially for something as confusing as health insurance and as important, they'd rather sit down with someone who can answer their questions. So it's a matter of personal choice.
Let's take another call. Go ahead, Sydney. No?
I was going to say, and one thing we have are sisters who help people who English is a second language. The International Institute and the Bilingual Institute here are both helping some of our immigrant communities.
All right. So the International Institute comes into play. If you have a language issue, contact those folks. We'll get some information on that up on our website as well. Let's take another call. Mary Ann in University City, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yes. I had read in the paper that there is a bill coming out of Jeff City to penalize insurance companies, take their licenses away, if they subsidize anyone who wants the Affordable Care Act. And I don't know if you've heard about this bill. I'm not sure if I have the information correct, but I thought that's what I read in the paper.
I think Jen has an answer for you. Go ahead, Jen.
Thank you so much.
Yes, there has been a bill filed that is an attempt to prevent people from getting those discounts for health insurance in Missouri. You know, it's just been filed. It's the beginning of session. Folks are looking at it. I certainly hope it doesn't go anywhere. I don't understand why anybody would want to do away with the subsidies that are making insurance affordable to people for the first time in years.
I believe, Sydney, if it goes anywhere, that it's not going to be enforceable. We've seen some court challenges trying to prevent the federal marketplace from being a vehicle to provide people with this premium assistance. And we've had the first court ruling yesterday out of the District of Columbia upholding the IRS rule that allows people who use the federal marketplace, as we are doing here, to get premium tax credits.
This issue is all over the courts, isn't it?
It's all over the courts. I am sure it will be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we will finally get a ruling there. But the court yesterday said that the law, when you look at it in its entirety, is quite clear.
Just a final question here, because I had someone ask me this, and I certainly didn't have the answer. And it deals with dental coverage and ophthalmological coverage in the Affordable Care Act. Is that available through the ACA?
Yes, and it's available through the marketplace. There are separate dental plans because most of our health insurance policies did not include dental care. Some of them on the marketplace do, and you can also check off a separate if you want dental care.
All right.
And really important also is that all kids' plans now have to cover both dental and vision care. So good for those kids to be getting that early dental care.
And these are elements of it that you don't hear anybody talking about.
We tend to focus on a few big elements, but there's a lot in the new laws for people to like, and a lot of people are taking advantage of it.
Well, Jen Bursdale, thank you so much for being with us. Our time is up, unfortunately. We could go on with this, and we'll do it another time, certainly before the next deadline, March 31st. And Sydney Watson, thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up, remembering Emmett Till, the youngster murdered in Mississippi for whistling at a white woman. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Many will cite the 1955 abduction and murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till as a major catalyst for the American civil rights movement that followed. Till was a young black Chicagoan visiting relatives in racially charged Mississippi. His abduction and murder occurred after he wolf-whistled at a white woman. Her husband was later tried and acquitted on charges of murdering the youngster. My guest in studio is Simeon Wright, Emmett Till's cousin. He was present during the whistling incident and was sleeping in the same bed with him when Till was abducted. He is the author of the 2010 book, Simeon's Story, An Eyewitness Account of the Kidnapping of Emmett Till. Simeon Wright, thanks so much for being with us. A pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Don, for having me here.
Tell me about Mississippi in that day. What was it like?
Well, in that day, we lived under the what you call the Jim Crow system. We had no right to vote. We had no equal access to the job market, whether locally or federal jobs. We had no protection under the law. This was the main, I would say, limb, the main thing that kept African-Americans under the foot of the segregationists. We had no protection under the law. We couldn't go to the law and get any kind of redress at all.
A totally different environment for young Emmett Till in Chicago at that time. Did he have any idea what kind of an atmosphere that he was getting into by traveling down for that visit in Mississippi?
I don't think he had a clear understanding of how it was then. His mother said she had told him how to act, but it just didn't sink in. He just couldn't imagine anything like that happening.
Well, tell us about his time down there before all of these other events took place. Was he adjusting to this? Did he become aware that this was a different environment?
Well, the week that he was there with us, we had no contacts with any other people outside except our boss man. He was German, so we really never had any problem with him. Mm-hmm. And we in Mississippi, we just had a ton of fun. You know, back in those days, you had someone visiting you from the north. Oh, my goodness, that was a joy.
And well, I guess looking at it from the other side, what were you hearing from him about what life was like in Chicago as opposed to what the life you were living?
Oh, my goodness. He told me about Riverview Amusement Park. I just couldn't imagine amusement park being that big. He told us about Lincoln Park Zoo and Lincoln Park area. Even now, when we take our kids on a Sunday school picnic, for the last 20-some years, we go to Lincoln Park area. And I heard about it from Emmett Till in Mississippi. It's beautiful.
What kind of a kid was he?
Fun-loving, had no fear, always laughing. I don't think I ever saw him angry. He was always laughing, always looking for something to do to make him laugh or to make you laugh.
You know, we've read many things about this particular case and about this young man. One of the things that I've read most recently was the fact that a lot of people considered him kind of cocky.
Not cocky, no, but fun-loving, you know. He laughs a lot. But as far as the image that they were displayed by the segregationists, no, he wasn't that type. Fun-loving, I wanted to be a comedian. That was his goal. He wanted to pattern his act after George Gobel because he had the deadpan look. That's the kind of guy he was.
Isn't that ironic that he wanted to be a comic and yet he was caught up in such a horrible, horrible situation as he was?
Yes.
You were with him during the incident that triggered the whole rest of the story, that being the grocery store, Quick Trip kind of shop, whatever it was. Tell us about what was going on there.
Well, we had picked cotton all day, and we had supper. Then we decided we were going to go to Money. My brother Maurice, 16, was driving the car.
It's a little grocery store of some sort.
Yeah, it was a grocery store. Money was about 3 miles west of where we lived. Behind Money was the Tallahatchie River, and we went to the little store, and my nephew, Wheeler Parker, he came down to visit also with Emmett. And he went in the store first. Then Emmett went in behind him. Wheeler came out. My brother Maurice sent me in there to be in there with him and to make sure that he didn't say anything out of line. You know? And while I was in the store with him, he said nothing out of line. He paid for his items. We both left the store together. And for some reason, Mrs. Bryant came out. She was the wife of this store owner. And she was walking to her car. And for some reason, he whistled at her, wolf whistle. It scared us half to death.
And how did she react to that?
Well, she gave him a long look, you know, because when Emmett saw our reaction, it scared him because he thought it was funny. To him, that was funny. To us, that was You didn't do that in Mississippi. You didn't whistle at nothing white in Mississippi.
Why not? What was wrong with that?
We had never heard of no one had put any type of a punishment on it, but we knew better. We knew not to whistle at a white woman in Mississippi. No, that didn't cross our mind. And you know, someone asked me, said, why did he do it? I said, I think he wanted us to laugh.
Well, nobody laughed,
nobody
I'm sure.
Laughed.
Nobody
laughed.
And somebody, certainly nobody has laughed since.
We all ran. We got out of there.
Did you think once you got away that it was over?
Yes, because someone said, why did you run? I said, it's just like breaking a window. You don't hang around if you break someone's window. And after we got home, we thought it was over. We thought maybe that if Mr. Bryant caught us, he may whip us or something like
that's
that.
That's the husband of the woman.
Yeah, the husband. But we had no idea that he would be killed for this. That didn't cross our mind.
Did you talk to him about it? And when you got home and went like this, wow, I'm glad that's over. Did you say anything to him?
When we got home, my brother Maurice, actually before we got home, because there was a car behind us, and my brother Maurice stopped the car. We were about 2 miles down the road. Everybody jumped out of the car except me. And it was a neighbor going home. But when they got back to the car, Maurice told him, man, you don't do anything like that. And that's when he begged us. He said, please, please, don't tell Uncle Mo what I did. I don't want to go home, because he knew Dad was going to send him home.
That takes us to the abduction. You were with them. You were sleeping in the same room.
Yes.
What happened?
About 2:30 that night, I heard loud talking in the house. And when I opened my eyes, at the foot of my bed, I saw two white men. One had a .45 and a flashlight. He ordered me to lay back down. He made Emmett get up and put his clothes on. First, he asked him a lot of questions. Were you the boy that did all the talking, money? And Emmett said, yeah. And he got angry because Emmett didn't say, yes, sir. And he made Emmett dress. And by this, I still don't know what's going on. Then my mother came in there. She was half talking, half crying, offering them money to leave him alone. The husband of Carolyn Bryant kind of hesitated, but J.W. Milan, he didn't. They marched him out of the room. Before they left the room, he asked my dad, he said, how old are you? My dad said, I'm 64. He said, if you tell anybody about this, you won't live to get 65.
How did these guys get into the house?
Back then, we didn't lock the door. They knocked. They came up on the porch. We had a porch the length of the whole house, and they knocked on my dad's door. They called him preacher. When my dad opened the door, they were standing with a gun.
And
no doors were locked.
So they marched him out of there.
They marched him out to a truck.
How did it unfold from that point on?
Well, they asked the lady in the truck, is this the right boy? She responded, yes.
Well, that would have been the wife?
That, to this day, we believe it was Carolyn Bryant. She said it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But
okay,
I believe it was the wife.
So he was identified as the one who had been in the store and did the whistling. What
right.
Then? What then?
Mm-hmm. And they drove him off, and we never saw him alive again.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take before his body was discovered?
He was kidnapped on a Sunday morning. We found the body Wednesday.
And where did you find the body?
A young fisherman was fishing. He saw a leg stick up out of the Tallahassee River, which was about 20 miles north of where we live. And when they pulled the body out, that was Emmett.
When he was taken from the house, did you folks, the family, feel that this might be the outcome of that abduction?
I think my mother did, because she couldn't be consoled. I could hear, you know, it's a voice that I never leave you. You hear half talking, half crying. And my daddy had to take her out of the house. And he took her to her brother's house, who lived in Sumner, where the trial took place. And she never set foot in the house again. But during the time that my mother and father was away from the house, we said nothing. I laid in that bed. I did not move. My brother, in my bedroom, there's two beds. My brother Robert was sleeping in one bed. Emmett and I was in the other one. I was so shaken by it that lay there, I couldn't say nothing. I couldn't tell anybody anything.
How did these two men come to be arrested?
Well, when my daddy got in touch with the sheriff and told him what happened, identified the men, the sheriff knew exactly who he was talking about. and they went then and arrested Roy Bryant first.
Roy Bryant was obviously the husband of
the husband of Callan Bryant.
And what was the name of the other fellow?
J.W. Milam. He was the mean guy. He was the guy with the gun.
Well, I guess people looking back and knowing a little bit about the South at that time, going to the sheriff didn't necessarily guarantee that any action was going to be taken.
No. This sheriff of Lee Floyd County, that's where we live, he claimed that he was going to do something. He did what he could. I think that the sheriff of Tallahatchie County, where he was killed, first he was kind of on the side of the prosecution, but someone got to him because during the trial he testified for the defense.
How was Emmett murdered? Was he just drowned?
No, he was beaten. He was beaten brutally. Then he was shot in the head with a .45.
And then tossed into
Tallahatchie River.
How long after this did the trial occur?
The trial started, the jury selection. The trial started the 19th of September. So you're talking within a month.
That's pretty fast.
That's fast.
And certainly fast by today's standards.
By today's standards.
Was it fast by the standards of the day in that place?
Well, it was unheard of by that standard for a white man being charged with murdering a black man. That was unheard of in Mississippi. Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the trial. Did you attend the trial?
I attended the trial because the ring that was taken off Emmett's body, he let me wear that ring the first day that he got there. Mm-hmm. And when the sheriff showed the ring to my dad, I was the one to identify the ring. And they kept me in the witness room all during that time.
So in the witness room, you did not necessarily see all of the testimony?
I didn't see all of the testimony. Uh-huh. But I was in there with one of the main witnesses, Willie Reed.
Who was Willie Reed?
He was the one that saw Emmett and two other black men on the back of the truck and Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam in the cab of the truck.
And that would have been following the abduction, taking
that him. That was following the abduction, yes.
Taking him away.
Right.
What was your – we have some time left, and perhaps someone in the audience would like to talk to you. I'll give the number, 38255. We'll have a chance for a call or two as we continue our conversation with Simeon Wright. But tell me what your testimony was to be.
I was to identify the ring.
Identify the ring.
Right.
But you were also a witness to the initial incident.
But they didn't ask me when I had to go give a deposition. They never asked me what happened in the store.
Did anybody testify to that?
They didn't want that out. Carolyn gave a statement, but it wasn't a testimony because she wasn't on oath.
Why would they not want that out?
Because they didn't want the world to know what happened at the store. The boy whistled at Callum Bryan. He was killed for that. But she said that he put his arms around her and asked her for a date and said, "What's the matter, baby? I've been with white women before," and that never happened.
So they exaggerated what had happened outside that store.
Exactly. It changed the mood of the people when she made that statement.
Yeah. What kind of a woman was she?
Well, she was... We didn't know too much about it because who hardly ever went in that store. Mm-hmm. This happened to be on a Wednesday, and all of the stores and money closes on Wednesday except that store. They were supposed to close, but they were so bad they wouldn't close that store. So ordinarily, we wouldn't go in that store. So I didn't know too much. Only other incident I had with a friend of mine, our school was right across the street from there. He went over there, had a slot machine in their store, mm-hmm. and he won, I don't know what it was, a couple of dollars. She wouldn't pay off. So that's why we stayed out of there.
How old a woman was she and her husband?
At that time, she was 21. I believe her husband was 24.
Somehow I had the feeling that they were older than that.
No.
They were acquitted.
Yes, they were.
Surprised?
I was shocked. But my dad wasn't. I 12 years of age, used to see in Western, you catch the bad guys, he go to jail. That's what mm-hmm. I'm thinking.
Yeah, what kind of reaction was there to that verdict? Not only with you and your friends and your family, but in the community itself.
Well, the white population was rejoicing as if, they're at a circus or something. They were rejoicing, high fiving. Well, they weren't high fiving back then, but they was doing their little thing, congratulations, whatnot.
Right. Hard to imagine. Emmett Till has become one of the most famous names in the history of race relations and civil rights in this country because of the incident that you have just described. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, you lived through a big part of this. You lived through all of it, actually.
Actually, yes.
Your thoughts about the impact it's had on this country since?
Well, the first impact, it changed me and all of my friends. It changed us overnight. Our whole attitude changed. We took the attitude and said, hey, they're going to kill us anyway, so we might as well fight back. So we began to resist. And that's really what some said started to say. It didn't start the civil rights movement, but it brought more people in. More people were brought into the civil rights movement to try to get equal justice for all Americans.
Was it a slow process? I mean, you're talking 1955, and the thing really started to build momentum a little bit later than that, more toward the 60s, I would say.
Well, it was a violent process. A lot of people were killed because just for the simple fact of trying to vote, they was killed for that.
Yeah.
And that's what slowed it down because, you know, you could go out and demonstrate for something, figure you're going to come back home. But thinking that you're going to die for this, it slows you down.
How far was this incident from, I guess it was Oxford, Mississippi, where the three young men from the North were killed, Cheney and Schwerner, and I've forgotten the name of the other young man who were killed.
Goodman,
yeah.
Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Right.
How far away was that from where this Emmett Till incident occurred?
As far as mileage or years?
Well, no, I know the years in terms of proximity, the mileage.
I would say about 80 miles to the southwest.
What was it about Mississippi? I mean, that's the state that everybody kind of points to where all the bad, not all, but so many of the bad things were happening and so many of the kind of attitudes that you described earlier in our conversation. What was it about Mississippi?
Well, if you were a landowner, you had free labor, and you would kill before you give that up.
But it wasn't free labor in 1955.
$2 a 100 pounds of cotton.
Free labor in the sense that—
They worked
nothing.
You all year. Most of the plantation around there, the average land that people could have was 5 acres. You couldn't live off of that. Like I said, we had a German as a boss. He gave my dad 40 acres so he could make a good living off of that.
So the German was German-born, is that it? He was not from that part of the world at all.
He was German-born and married a girl from Mississippi. Uh-huh. But the whole thing about it is economics.
I'm curious as to how this evolved. You talked about the violence and about how it led to the civil rights movement. Give me some sense of how it changed from 1955 to the early 1960s, where you were.
Well, early 1960s, it was about the same.
Yeah.
After, you know, they had the bombing in Birmingham, 63. Megan Everett was killed in 63. So around 1968, things began to really change. Because I can remember going to Memphis in 1969. We couldn't go into hotels. Mm. We had to stay with friends.
What was the feeling like for you living in that from after Emmett's death and having this same kind of attitude prevail? And was there a feeling of helplessness, hopelessness, that this is never going to change?
Well, what happened was after the trial, after the verdict, we left Mississippi. Mm-hmm. My dad and I, my two brothers, we left that Saturday. We sold our stuff that Saturday and we was on the train that Monday getting out of Mississippi.
Because of the murder?
Because of the verdict.
Because of the verdict?
The verdict.
Because you knew that this stuff was not going to stop?
Not going to stop.
Right.
It was the verdict that changed a lot of people's mind.
Other members of the family also left, didn't they?
Well, my mother left the same night.
Did you feel that you were going to be targeted if you stayed?
I didn't have that fear. You know, a young idealist, I wanted to fight back. But
you're 12 years old.
Yeah, but we only had two guns.
Oh, so it got to that point where there wasn't enough weapons to—
That knocked me out of the box. But that's the attitude I had then.
And where did you go when you left?
We went to a suburb of Chicago, a place called Summit, Argo Summit, where they make Argo starch.
Uh-huh.
That's where I finished my education at.
So you got as far away from Mississippi as you could.
As far
away north. It's a fascinating story, and we can only hit the highlights or lowlights, however you want to describe it, with Simeon Wright, the cousin of Emmett Till. That's what we've been talking about. Simeon Wright will be appearing tomorrow evening at Chaminade as part of the second annual Martin Luther King celebration. The free presentation at 6 will be followed by a benefit jazz concert for which there is a charge. We have details at stlpublicradio.org. Thinking of the Martin Luther King Day celebration, given what you've been through, this must be a very, very, very special day and time for you to celebrate Martin Luther King Day.
Very, very special. For the simple reason, when he came to Chicago to march, I didn't qualify to march with him.
Because?
I said, you slap me, I'm going to slap you back. Oh. So they didn't want us.
They didn't want you.
No.
So much to be told, and we also have the book that I alluded to, Simeon's Story, an Eyewitness Account of the Kidnapping of Emmett Till. That's still available as well. Simeon Wright, thanks so much for being with us. Enjoy your stay in St. Louis, and thanks for being with
us. Okay, thanks for having me.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about the Black Reps production of The Meeting, dramatizing a supposed meeting between Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He'll also visit with St. Louisan and Sarajevo refugee Zlatko Čozić about his exhibit, Still Adjusting, opening next week in Umzel's Gallery 210. And in the next installment of Soundbites, produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll take a look at the year ahead in food and drink. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll revisit our program on linguistics, examining how language forms and evolves. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, and Spencer Reed. And today we say thanks and goodbye to Mission Continues fellow Jeremy Bailey, who has contributed so much to our efforts during the last 4 months. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.